negotiations, and I had my my PO off, and you guys happen to come in up here on that other receiver. Thank you for the information. KC-6 and Lincoln Frank Paul, clear.
Yes, out here on Long Island, there is a repeater with the call letters W2KPQ, but that is a 449.125 repeater, which is not linked. Oh, let me take that back. Yeah, this repeater, there is two repeaters on 2 meters that are linked together during this net. This one is 146.85, and there's another Long Island repeater with those call letters, which is 147.375. So, yes, those two repeaters are linked together during this net, and looking forward to hearing from you next week, or whatever you feel like signing in. It's been around a long time. We believe this net is coming close to hitting a record for the most number of years of service with essentially the same leadership, and the total number of hours on the air is quite a few thousand. This is technical net number 1,585. When it first got started in 1982, let me drop. Me and N2FDJ, the guys who started in those days, we decided to answer people's technical questions. We thought we would do it for a couple of months, answer all the questions, dry up and go away. 33 years ago, and we've won some national awards because of the service that we're supposedly supplying to these people. We gather people who share information with each other as to how to make all this electronics work well. So that's a popular subject, and there's also new hams all the time. I think we're up to something like 730,000 hams in the United States right now, an all-time high. So, John's going to give us the mailbag questions for this week. KC2WGB. KC2RAW in the TechNet. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Everyone on the net. Yep, we got a few questions here. Gentleman Mark would like your opinion on RF radiation causing orbital problems with the Earth. Over the many years of transmissions, we have put trillions and trillions of watts out into the atmosphere. Think in any way, it sounds like our moon question, if you remember. Do you think in any way it's changed the path, or the speed, or the rotation of the Earth? You'd like your opinion on that, sir. KC2WGB, back to you.
I'm going to surprise you guys with my answer on this one. The answer is yes, but how much? Because the total mass of the Earth, I think it's 10 to the 27 kilograms. That's a big number. The Earth is a very heavy object. And when it comes to RF radiation creating a force, the force that a zillion watt transmitter creates is nano-newtons of force, very little force. We're talking about micro-ounces type stuff here. And when you're trying to move something as heavy as the Earth, which I think is 10 to the 27 kilograms, did it move differently? Yes. The total amount of motion, maybe it's a fraction of the diameter of one atom, if you know what I mean. So everything has an action and reaction, no matter how small. I mean, there are people, for instance, you heard earlier, because the signal you're listening to is only a microvolt, a very small amount of signal, you would like to think that making a change in the performance of an antenna is not going to count. Well, where the antenna, the way decibels work, whether the signal is 40 volts or whether the signal is 40 tenths of a microvolt, doesn't matter. You're going to get the exact same change in performance because you've made a 6 dB change in the gain of the antenna, in my example. Because every reaction has an equal and opposite reaction. Yes, RF energy is creating a force, and those transmitters are favoring certain directions. Like when I turn on a transmitter for broadcast, it is favoring that particular hemisphere, everything above the Earth near that transmitter, if you know what I mean. So you're creating a force in that direction, but the Earth is continuously rotating, so the accumulation of that force is a little bit complicated. And no matter how small...
Repeater, timeout.
No matter how small the force is, it's doing something. So the answer is yes. But if you had to measure it, it's approximately equivalent to I spit in the ocean and you try to measure the change in the height of the tide because I did that. Did I really add some extra water to the ocean when I spit in the ocean? Absolutely. You and I could calculate how many molecules higher the tide is going to be Long Island Sound because I did that. But you know darn well it's going to be an extremely small number, a very small fraction of the diameter of one atom. So without a doubt there's an action. I wouldn't lose a lot of sleep out of this one. The most striking question along these lines was Voyager. Let me drop it. Voyager is out there for 37 years moving away from the Earth at something like 40,000 miles an hour today, and because NASA has a very accurate deep space network by which, in theory, they can resolve the range to Voyager down to inches, even though it is 12 billion miles away. And the guys that are making very careful measurements have noticed a continuous shift in the position they predicted for Voyager versus the real position. It is slowing down a little bit continuously for all of those 37 years. It was a bit of a mystery. And he finally found out what's doing it. And that is all of the thermal energy of the radioactive thermal generator and all of the heat being generated by the electronics, all of that electronics is on the back side of the parabolic dish antenna that's 8 or 10 feet in diameter, aimed at the Earth in order for that 8.5 gigahertz downlink signal from Voyager to get to the Earth so that we can read its data. All of that heat being continuously radiated from the backside of the dish has made a very slight but measurable amount of slowdown of Voyager. Now, if you really calculate the position that Voyager should be, let me drop, versus the position of where it is, we're probably talking about a change in position of one part in 10 to the 10, I'm guessing. But it is very measurable because the genius of that deep space network, because every cycle you send up to Voyager gives you a given number of cycles that comes back down because of the way that transponder operates. Therefore, you can count every wavelength you have issued to it and every wavelength that you get back. And because those wavelengths are a couple of inches, a little bit more than an inch in wavelength, you've got some capability of ridiculous accuracy. So the heat given off by Voyager changed its position by a measurable amount. So the radio waves are doing that. But I wouldn't lose a lot of sleep out of it. Also, because of the way the tides interact with the moon in its orbit is moving out 1.5 inches per year. Let me drop it. The moon moves further away from the Earth, 1.5 inches per year, because of the interaction of the tides and the Earth rotating under the moon, and the Earth has to rotate through those tides. The friction of the water hitting the land masses creates a phase shift in the tides. The tides move a little bit forward of where the moon is, so to speak. It's like when you have a ball on the end of a string, and if you move your hand in a characteristic manner, you're adding energy to that ball, and you can make the ball speed up if you move your hand just right. Well, the tide is doing that, and the moon is slowly moving outward. A zillion years ago, the moon used to be at possibly half the distance it is right now. And so what's really happening is the rotational kinetic energy of the Earth is slowly being coupled into the moon's orbit. The Earth probably had a much shorter day. For all we know, we had a 15-hour day zillions of years ago compared to the 24-hour day we have today because of the moon interaction. Everything has action and reaction. You can't get away from that. But sometimes it's like spitting in the ocean. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good, very interesting. Good question. Thought about that. KC2WGB. Okay. Now, let me let it drop, and we've got a question here on what he thinks is long path. All right. Okay, this gentleman has a 40-meter Yagi, 8-element. It's up about 60 feet. He has a friend that's about 12 miles away, and he cannot speak with him. It's extremely noisy. Occasionally, he finds him buried in the noise. So this is going on for a while. Now, turn the antenna around 180 degrees, and he believes, and he thinks he may be 50-50 in his correctness, that he's talking to him long past. Or could it be that it's bouncing off something in the distance and making a different difference showing up and hitting him that way? He'd like your opinion on what you think is going on there. And he says if it is long past, it's very good, and he can carry on a constant conversation with a guy 12 miles away pointing in the opposite direction. Incredible.
Question, K6DPC, did you say a 40-meter Yagi with that many elements?
You hit the exact same thing I did, Hal. He said 8 elements on 40 meters. If it was an 8-element Yagi on 40 meters, that boom is close to 150 feet long. Run that by again, John. KC2WGB, did we slip a decimal point here? KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet. Bye-bye, sir.
Yeah, this boy is in Pennsylvania, and he's got what looks like the Bayonne Bridge up there with all of the support strands from the extension of the mast holding the end of this. This thing, it's a monster. So, yeah, I was surprised too.
Now remember, you've heard me say quite often, you take a random length of wire, which probably on HF frequencies has a standing wave ratio of 1,000 to 1. You plug it into the center conductor of the UHF connector on the back of your HF receiver, and you start listening to 80, 40, 20 meters, and you'll hear signals. And these signals sound pretty good. The signal strength meter is going to be 6S units lower than it would be if connected to a real antenna. But the noise of the horizon, the noise of the ionosphere, the noise of the atmosphere on HF frequency and man-made noise quite often is a 30 or 40 decibel noise figure. In other words, the noise of the atmosphere could easily be 30 or 40 dB louder than it would be on UHF frequencies. As such, when you've got a yucky antenna that's got, let me pick a number, 30 decibels of loss, that means that the noise that's 40 dB above threshold is now only 10 dB above threshold. You've added 30 dB of loss in your ability to hear the noise and your 30 dB of loss of the ability to hear the signal. But you've cut down the signal and the noise by the same amount. The automatic gain control of your receiver takes over. You get very little S-meter deflection, but the signal coming out of the loudspeaker sounds beautiful. You can do that on HF frequencies. Try that on UHF frequencies, you're going to be very disappointed, because the UHF frequencies are much, much quieter. What you're proving to yourself is that quite often you'll talk to people who say, gee, I'd like to be on 20 meters today, but the 20-meter band is closed. Let me drop. Does that mean the signals on 20 meters are not propagating? Oh, they're propagating like crazy. You could go to a 146 megacycle frequency, 144 megacycle frequency, VHF, 432 megacycle frequency. Talk to your buddy 1, 10, 100 miles away, easy as all hell. Go to an HF frequency with a super high gain antenna like this guy is using, and you would say, gee, that signal should be gangbusters. The guy is almost line of sight. If I got a tall enough tower and a good set of binoculars, I should be able to see his antenna, or at least his house. And you're saying, how can the signal not get there? The signal is getting there. Every signal you transmit goes to every single cubic centimeter of this universe. You can't stop it from doing that. However, how good is the equipment that you're getting on the other end, and what is the competing noise? A little bit similar to, I can't hear you when I'm in the shower. Or when your spouse is in the shower, and that very noisy shower head is a couple of inches away from her head. She's hearing a very loud noise. You're on the outside of the bathroom shouting to her, and she can hear you making some sound, but she doesn't understand you. But she speaks softly, and you have no trouble hearing her. Well, you're not near that noisy showerhead. You hear her voice very well. This is on HF frequency. When the 20-meter band is closed, it doesn't mean the signals are not getting there. It just means the way the propagation on the ionosphere is working. Let me drop it. The noise that's almost always there is overriding that microvolt signal that you're trying to listen to. That signal you're trying to listen to might be a microvolt, but the noise of the atmosphere might be 15 microvolts, if you know what I mean. It's covering up your signal. So when the ionosphere on, let's say, 20 meters, 40 meters, when it favors your signal between point A and point B, that ionosphere can easily make the signal 90 decibels louder than it wouldn't be if the ionosphere was not doing its thing for that particular path at that time. That signal reflecting off the ionosphere, acting like a mirror, can easily make the signal 90 decibels stronger than it would be without the ionosphere. We only have ground wave propagation, but you still have all of that noise. There's a zillion thunderstorms going on around the Earth simultaneously. They're all making lightning stroke chunks of noise. The ionosphere itself is being heated up by the solar wind, making a whole lot of noise. And on HF frequencies, on most locations, there's a hell of a lot of man-made noise. Let me drop it. Fluorescent lights in that parking lot that's a mile away from your house, and so on. So, can long path be doing it when short path is not doing it? Absolutely. Is it a reflection off something and bouncing back? Not impossible, but not likely. When you, the nearest reflecting object on 40 meters that has enough radar cross-section, enough area to it, like a full-size aircraft carrier broadside. If a mile away from your house there was a full-size broadcast carrier, full-size aircraft carrier broadside reflecting that signal, and the aircraft carrier, by the way, is being suspended in the air by a mile, and now our signal is reflecting off of it and getting back to your buddy, absolutely, that could happen. But as you can tell, it would take a very large object. But can long path do it? Absolutely. Now, the next question is, you would think that long path should also do it when you aim at him. The signal you aim directly at him, you would think the signal, because he's inside of the skip zone where the first bounce doesn't favor your buddy, but the signal goes through the chunk of real estate above your buddy's head, goes all the way around the earth and wraps around and comes back to your buddy again. That's another kind of long path. The difference with that kind of long path is only a couple of miles longer than the aiming the antenna backwards long path. And so why did that long path not make it is an interesting question. I don't have a good answer for that one. Maybe when he aims the antenna away from his buddy, he's now aiming it over a within some reasonable number of miles over a body of water, and the first couple of bounces off the Atlantic Ocean can really favor that path. Whereas the long path aimed directly at your buddy, let me drop it. To aim at your buddy, the long path has to go through a couple of bounces of the United States before it gets to the Pacific Ocean. So the beginning of that path is nowhere near as favorable as the reverse path. So from the evidence we're hearing, I am guessing that long path is doing it. Hal has got a lot more HF experience than I do. Hal, if you happen to be listening, what's your guess? K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, Hal's not with us now. So, by the way, aiming directly away from your buddy isn't the only way the long path could get there. Because the two of you are so close together, if you aim 30 degrees clockwise and 30 degrees counterclockwise from being exactly away from your buddy, the long path will get there. Because the two of you are so close together, the long path always has to come back to the origin, if you know what I mean. So, swinging a few more degrees in either direction and find out does the signal get stronger or weaker would be a fun thing to do. Now, when he does talk to his buddy long path, I am guessing both his buddy and him are aiming the antennas away from each other, assuming his buddy also has an aimable antenna. Also, the possibility exists that, let me drop, Because of local terrain and the way his buddy has set up his antenna, which maybe is not aimable, it's possible that his buddy's antenna radiates a signal stronger away from him than toward him, again favoring the long pass. Lots of variables in this case, but I like the sound of long pass, and I think it could very well be real. KC2 WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. Have him give us feedback as he does further experiments on this one, John. Over to you, John.
KCWGB. Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. Long pass and the reverse long pass, which would be the forward long pass, is only a 12-mile difference in the two of them. So why doesn't that work? Very good question. Okay, also, looking at this picture, I'm noticing that you and Hal might be right, although I can't determine the length of the boom. Might be a two-band Yagi because some of the elements look smaller than the other ones. So it may be a dual band, but this thing is a monster. Now, I will contact him because I would like to know the boom length, and I'll see if he can give me an answer. I'd like to know what he finds. Okay. So let me let it drop. I'll go on to the next one.
KC2QIQ with a comment? Glenn recognized, but before, John, do you know the call letters of this guy? I'd love to look him up on QRZ.com. Guys who put up an antenna that big almost always put a picture on a website as well as QRZ. What's his call letters, John? Go ahead.
I don't have his call letters. Yeah, I'm just looking. Nope, they're not there. All right. But I may email him, and I will find out, get his call number. I'd like to look, too. This photograph he sent is pretty crummy, but it gives you a good idea what it looks like. So pick up the link, KC2WGB.
There's another way we can find him. Can you tell me the spelling of his last name and his first name?
It looks like Bruce Dreyer.
Dreyer, D-R-Y-E-R?
Yes.
Okay, we're going to look him up. Go over to you, Glenn, go right ahead.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Good evening to everybody on the net. Just a quick comment about 40 meters and directional antennas, beams, and having a lot of discussions with people on those bands. I've set up huge wire arrays. Typically, if you have a signal that's nearby, even on 20 meters, 20, 40, 80, all those HF bands, and point your antenna towards your buddy and start spinning your antenna around the other direction, and you start hearing them stronger. It's not long path. What it's really telling you is that your antenna is too low to the ground. My first question for him, John, would be, I would say, how high, if that's truly an antenna that's going to have that much gain and have that kind of pattern, he's probably going to have to be close to 70 feet off the ground before that thing's going to work properly. But that's my guess. He's probably got it somewhere around 30 feet, and he's going to see all kinds of crazy results in the pattern like you.
You've got it, John.
Yeah, Glenn, he says it's at 60 feet. I can only see the top of the tower. Don't see the whole tower. It looks like a homemade tower, but he claims it's 60 foot up, so, you know, he's close to 70.
That's getting close to a half wave on 40 meters, Glenn. What do you think?
And, of course, there's the other problem. Is there a building or some other structure, a water tower, something directly in the line shot that could also be causing the problem, too? So, you know, that's one of those things where it could be structures, all kinds of things. I know a lot of the guys that are down on 80, 40, that run the really, really big beams, they got them up, you know, 100 feet. And before they really start working nicely. Below that, I mean, they're great for, like, canceling off the side. Like, if you've got QRM in a direction, you can use size of beams to clear it out, but before they really start working like a VHF or UHF beam, you got to really get
that water tower that's near me, which is, I'm guessing, 25 or 30 feet in diameter. That's a big metallic object on 432 megacycles, and I've easily measured the echo I get off of that water tower when I aim at it. However, radar cross-section is a function of wavelength squared, 1 over wavelength squared. When you get down to 40 meters, where the wavelength is 130 30 feet. Until you get something the size of an aircraft carrier, you're not going to get a hell of a lot of echo off of it. A great big building, maybe. A water tower is really too small in wavelengths to give you much of an echo down there, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. There's no doubt about it, but I don't think that's what the issue is. If he was high enough in altitude, I would agree. But I don't think he's high enough in altitude yet. But I think he's really having a pattern problem. That especially with that number of elements at only 6 feet off the ground, he's probably still just getting a lot of ground reflection and other things off the pattern. Probably looks awful. One of the things I'd probably want to do if I was in his shoes is, got it at 60 feet, to have some local transmitters in the area go around it and see what kind of field strength measures side into the back, and that will probably be the most alarming thing. Let's put it this way, something that's going to give him a little bit more information about how the antenna is really performing. As a matter, he might even find out by taking half the elements off, it may work better, like you.
Although he may be mounted too close to the ground, not enough altitude, assuming the ground is flat, and assuming he doesn't have the Empire State Building a block away, if he's too close to the ground, but he's above flat ground, and now he walks around that antenna, how can that ground be giving him a brand new pattern? I'm a little bit confused by that one. In other words, whether he stands 5 blocks away to the north, 5 blocks away to the east, 5 blocks away to the south, 5 blocks away to the west, and he runs a strip chart recorder into a calibrated receiver while the antenna is rotated. Except for the Empire State Building be a block away, how would I not get the exact same antenna pattern each time he rotates in any one of those directions? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Well, generally, Dick, we don't do it that complicated. A lot of times we're doing it with a mobile, and drive a mobile at least a few miles away in, you know, pretty markway distances. Run like north, south, east, west. Leave the antenna fixed. Don't rotate it. Then you get all the measurements around the outside. Then you move it and take some more measurements. Generally, what happens when the antennas are low, I don't have an exact real answer for it, but I can tell you that you'll wind up with a lot of dead spots. Like all of a sudden, you'll have a really sharp clearing in the signal, and then you go around to another area just another mile away, and all of a sudden everything just drops out and it pops back up again. But when the antennas get high enough in the air, all that problem goes away. You don't see that anymore.
Yeah, what's a little bit confusing about that, Glenn, is that every well-tuned parabolic dish antenna on microwave frequencies has a bunch of side lobes, first, second, third, fourth side lobe. And in between those side lobes, you get some very deep notches. And whether or not the feed horn is in the right focal position, and whether or not the surface has the right surface accuracy, when the surface accuracy is just right, and the feed horn is in the right focal position, and all of those notches between the side lobes get deeper, that's literally the way you tune the antenna. When you're tuning the position for the feed horn, and if you were tuning the surface error, when the notches between the side lobes get deeper, you have hit maximum gain of that antenna. Ain't that crazy? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Oh, yeah. You know, the beauty is even from 10 meters on up, it's so much easier to work with the antennas because to get a few wavelengths off the ground, it's a piece of cake, and you can really see the definition in field strength. But now at 80 meters and 20 meters, you know, the general size of the antennas and the patterns are not that straightforward. And if you were to try to scale them, you know, the same way that we work on our VHF and UHF antennas, when you have a VHF or UHF antenna 40 feet off the ground, the equivalent wavelength, you'd have to be like 400 feet air to get similar performance. That's why with beams, it gets a little crazy. But, you know, there are places in Pennsylvania where you have enough real estate in North Carolina, and guys set up beautiful quad towers and string huge wire arrays. Quite a few guys over in the UK have got some pretty decent property over there, too. I talk to them down at 80 meters all the time and raise, but they have to get them up there to really, to get the correct patterns where they're very predictable. Otherwise, when they're low to the ground, they start getting, like, very, very finicky. You turn the beam a little bit, and it gets very choppy, and you get a lot of QSB on the signals, and it's not that nice. Back to the K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, thank you, Glenn. by way of the length of the driven element, first directors, whatever, assuming they don't have great big loading coils in them, you know that a 40-meter dipole is going to be close to 67, 65 feet long. So by using the driven element as a scaling device, you may be able to make a rough guess as to what the length of the boom is on that 8-element Yagi on 40 meters. I think we're getting close to 150 foot of boom length here, John. It might be kind of fun to scale that off that picture and see if you can make a rough guess. You should be able to tell the difference between 100 foot and 150 foot for boom length. KC2WGB, K2LAW, fun stuff. Some of these guys really get serious, John.
Yeah, this guy's got a fortune in metal. I'm going to assume it's a lot truer. Angle of the antenna, hard to measure the, all right, I will take that up and I'm going to find out. A lot of interesting questions showing up with this, but I think it's probably a dual bander, although he didn't mention that would cut the boom lanes down. All right, I'll let this drop, on to the next one. KC2WG, oh, interesting question here, glad Glenn's around too. I've taken hard drives apart, pull out those neodymium magnets, and I'm sure a lot of guys have. Well, this young scientist would like somebody to answer, how does it work, the question. Notices when he has the magnet side toward the bench, it will pick up a paper clip from quite a distance. But when he turns it around, that plate it's mounted on, almost no magnetic effect is met. He can't even pick up the small screw. He wants to know, this plate is about 2 millimeters. What's going on? If it was on a piece of steel or on a piece of copper, that magnetic field would go right through. So what's happening with that? Why is it like a one-sided magnet? Back to you, Dick.
I have one of those neodymium magnets that came out of the hard drive in my hand as we speak. And I've done that exact experiment. The front end, the black end of the magnet, boy, has it got Stucci magnetic field. The back end with that metal plate is very, very little. It must be 30 times weaker. There's some magnetic field back there, but it's 30 times weaker. I'm now trying to pull it away from a great big chunk of steel. Forward, I've got to apply a lot of force. Backwards, it almost falls away. Not quite. I'm pretty sure that the neodymium magnet, let me think about that. Yes. I'm pretty sure it is magnetized in a way where the magnetic field is flowing normal to the flat surface of the black object. The magnetic field flows out of there normal to that surface. That gives you the greatest amount of action of the way you have to move the head on that hard drive because of the way everything runs at right angles. And I'm pretty sure that's the way it's done. So what's going on is that metal plate that it's mounted to is taking that perpendicular magnetic field coming off the back end of the neodymium magnet and spreading it out across that whole great big metal plate that it's mounted to. That metal plate is not quite, but it's coming very close to being a good magnetic shield. It diverts all the magnetic field away from the usual direction out toward the perimeter. I noticed that my particular neodymium magnet, pulled away from this chunk of steel, yes, off the edges of that metal plate in the back, I've got a fair amount of magnetic field. Off the flat surface, I've got almost nothing. So it's taking the magnetic field from that black neodymium thing.
Repeater, timeout.
It's taking the magnetic field from the back and spreading it out tremendously in area and diverting it into another direction. So it is a quasi-magnetic shield is my best guess as to what's going on here, John. Fun experiment. And boy, are those things potent. These neodymium magnets are orders of magnitude stronger. And the best thing we used to have in the old days was samarium cobalt. Before that, it was Alnico, aluminum nickel cobalt. We've come a long way with magnets over the years. Do you remember in the early days, and you're in my early days, in 1950, the strongest magnet you could buy in those days was called Alnico. By modern-day standards, I wouldn't be a bit surprised it only has 1% of the strength of a modern-day neodymium magnet. Neodymium is good stuff. The bad news is that we don't have it locally in the United States. We've got to import it. And the countries that have got the neodymium are suddenly realizing how valuable this stuff is. And I think they're starting to charge high prices and starting to restrict exporting. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, we have some KC2WGB, but, you know, the mining and the restrictions, it's like all the rare earth stuff, it's tough to mine it here with some of the laws. So I know Afghanistan has a bunch of it, China, but yeah, the rest of the world drive first. All right. Yeah, you know, I just tested mine, and I can't pick up a paper clip on that opposite side, but boy, if I stick this thing onto the Zerner here, it doesn't move. You got to put a lot of force there to take it off. All right, I think we should go over to Paul. That's it from the mailbag, and let's see what he's got out in space. Casey, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Sunday's issue of Newsday shows a craft that's sitting on the launch pad with 7,500 pounds of material that they want to bring up to the International Space Station. And I think they've already been delayed a couple of days because of high winds. So give us some words on this one, Paul. WS2N with space report number 178, I think it is. K2LIW on the TechNet. You got it, Paul. By the way, make a brief transmission. Let's see how well you're coming through and whether or not you should use the Eastern input today, Paul. Go ahead.
Okay, fine business. This is WS2N. And, yeah, well, the, how am I making it? It'll take me 1 second to reverse.
Loud and clear. Stay as is. All's well. Go ahead.
Okay, good to know. Yeah, that was the Cygnus spacecraft that you were looking at. And today was day four, you know, day one, two, and three. All were canceled due to weather, primarily wind exceeded the 25-mile or roughly 22-knot constraint and red line that the computers automatically shut down. If you get within 4 minutes, it'll get past the red line and it'll shut it down, and then they'll just put it off for another 24 hours. But what they were doing, of course, this rocket that they're using, the Atlas V, is much larger than what they've used in the past. They have, instead of an instantaneous window, they had a half an hour to play with. So they ran up that half hour each and every day. But today at 4:44, it did take off. I did watch it on NASA, and it was a perfect launch. Let me drop it. They're bringing up the almost 8,000 pounds, 7,500 pounds roughly, to the International Space Station. So good to watch. Launched by the United Launch Alliance. They're the ones that handle all the Delta II rockets, the Delta IV rockets, and the Atlas V rocket. And they got the job from Orbital ATK to launch the Cygnus spacecraft. Cygnus is built by Orbital, and you might remember 2 Octobers ago, they tried launching a Cygnus spacecraft from Wallops Island in Virginia. They've done it a couple of times and successfully gone up to the International Space Station. But that time, it got off the launch pad, it blew up, and they lost all their cargo and everything, and it put them really behind the eight ball until today. They're still working it. They've fixed their launch facility that got damaged, and they're still working on a new Antares rocket to be used in coming up in May. They'll put that back into operation. But in the meantime, they've had this couple of billion-dollar contract with NASA to bring up collectively at least 40,000 pounds. So each time they launch, they they've been launching. They've been putting up 3,500, 4,000 pounds, 5,000 pounds, getting bigger each time. But on this flight, they were scheduled to make the Cygnus spacecraft bigger anyway. It's got roughly 25% more volume and weight that they could put on the enhanced Cygnus spacecraft. So it's bigger. You could, it's physically longer, you can tell. Put two of them side by side. It's got some upgraded engines. It's got much lighter solar panels. In fact, the solar panels are completely different than the rectangular ones that used to pop out. They're circular. They open up like a fan, one on each side. And I said I was new on this flight about an hour and a half after launch. They got a chance to do that. That they opened up successfully. Now they'll hang out in orbit for about 2 days. Let's see, I think it's Wednesday before they get to the space station. And they're going to dock. They'll dock on the Unity node. There's different docking locations. Unity node has now been vacated by the Leonardo pressure mating module that they disconnected. Oh, last year, I think it was the beginning of this year, Scott Kelly and a couple of the other guys, they got on board the space station, disconnected that module and relocated it to another location, freeing up this one. And by doing that, they now have two docking ports berthing ports for cargo vehicles. So they'll dock that to Unity, first time that they'll be able to do that. The reason for that is they normally dock to the Harmony node, but they have another scheduled flight probably within a month or so by SpaceX. And if they get up there and they'll need a place to dock, SpaceX would be then docked to the Harmony node. And then you'll have two cargo spacecraft docked at the same time. Robot arm will disconnect the Cygnus spacecraft. It'll send that back, deorbit it, and that will burn up in the atmosphere. Unlike SpaceX Dragon does not burn up. SpaceX Dragon actually brings supplies back to the space station, including scientific equipment. I have a lot of things to cover, Dick, but you probably want to make a couple of comments on this before we go on. This is WS-20.
Don't have as many comments this week as I usually do, Paul. Although it's way off subject, I presume the James Webb 2018 launch is still on schedule. I haven't seen any recent news reports of them adding more of the mirror segments to that craft. You and I are quite worried about the fact that I think it's 18 segments have to all unfold and position themselves to the nearest micro-inch or a fraction of a micro-inch. Oh, boy. All doing that 1 million miles away from the Earth with no rescue capability, no way of going out there and repairing it. Everything's got to work just right, and there's a million steps of that thing unfolding itself from the launch vehicle. And when it finally unfolds itself, the thing is... It's a good fraction of the size of a football field, isn't it, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
No, not quite a football field, but they claim as big as a tennis court. ISS is a little bit bigger than a football field. Solar arrays on the ISS are about, collectively, square feet anyway. It's about half the size of a football field. But the James Webb is tiny and respect to that, but it's large compared to anything that they've put into space. The solar blankets will be will be about the size of a tennis court, and this whole contraption, this telescope, is going to sit on top. And like you said, 18 different segments, each one roughly a meter big, and each segment is hexagonal in shape. This all has to match perfectly and be within a certain millimeters of tolerance, so it should be interesting. Yeah, no, I have a few other things I could run through that I really got mind on. Dream Chaser is still in the running. They have another cargo contract coming up, which Orbital ATK, the one company I mentioned before that had built this Cygnus, they're in the running. Boeing is in the running with. They have a cargo version of the Starliner that they would like to use to go up to the space station. Dragon by SpaceX is another one. And but Dream Chaser is still in the running. They lost out last time to the manned flight. They plan on sending 7 people up to the space station at a time with their mini. Looks like a mini. Space shuttle, and they lost out on the manned version. They haven't given up on it, but they've been putting a lot of money.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
As the Dream Chaser, two wings coming out, Delta shape set up in the top of an Atlas. Is the same one that went up today. But they plan on putting it into these fairings of the Atlas V rocket. And to do that, they've decided to, the only way to do it is to have the wings actually hinged. They're going to fold in on one another. And when the fairings are released after a couple of minutes, when they get into space, Dream Chaser's wings would actually open up. And it would be able to be birthed with the space station to bring up cargo, and it would like the Dragon by SpaceX, it would be able to bring material and scientific equipment back to the ground, because it would land like an airplane on any almost any airfield you'd like. They don't have the hydrogen problems. They don't have the you don't have to worry about the pollutants, the dangers of that chemical that the shuttle has. You used to see the shuttle. They came out with, they look like spacesuits, the guys that were on the ground crew after it landed. You won't have that with Dream Chaser. So hopefully that comes off, and eventually they might be able to have a manned version in the future. So looking forward to that. That's by Sierra Nevada Corporation. They were headquartered in Colorado. Another spacecraft, we always talk international things here. Japan had launched a spacecraft to go to an asteroid, and it was launched about 10 months or so ago, about a year ago, and it's now coming back to Earth. So it's going to pass Earth for a gravity assist to eventually get out to its asteroid. The idea of it, it's called Hayabusa 2. Hayabusa 1 was another one that did the same thing, but this one's more an upgraded version. The idea is to bring material back from an asteroid and also to investigate the asteroid. So when they go out there, instead of having one lander, this thing has 4 landers on board, and they're going to go down to the asteroid and actually hop along the surface and take measurements. And then this big spacecraft itself will actually go down close to the, almost hovering at the surface. We'll suck in some material and bring it back in, 2020 or something like that, and bring it back to the Earth. So hopefully Hayabusa works out. I mean, they also, again, I always have room on some of these launches. They did have enough room for 2 passive spacecraft that were launched with it, and both of them had ham radio transmitters on it. They said they were amateur radio people that did copy this. I don't know what the frequencies were, but one of them is dead, not working anymore, and the other one is actually, because they make an orbit around the Earth, this other small passive satellite that was launched with Hayabusa 2 is actually going to come around here past Earth and the amateur community that followed us will actually try to pick it up. One of them is still active. So it's just a like countless more things going on. There's so much going on in space that I could probably go on and on. Problems with the ISS, or, you know, different things. European Space Agency just put another spacecraft, which could be there in a couple of months. They launched another one called LISA Pathfinder. I will get to its location, L1 location, probably in a couple of months, and that'll be in a halo orbit, and it's a test vehicle, technical things that they got on this thing, which they want to see if it works. If it works, they'll size it up for a much bigger version, probably 10 years from now. The idea of it is to see if they can pick up gravity waves. So it's called the LISA Pathfinder mission. Fascinating to read about all the equipment on board this thing and sensitivity of some of these things that are floating around on the inside of the spacecraft. So they just want to see if it all works, and if it works, they'll put it on three different spacecraft and have the spacecraft fly at 600,000 miles. It's a couple of times the diameter, the distance between here and the moon, that far apart from one another, to see if they could pick up gravity waves, probably in 2030. So that's pretty much it, Dick. Turn it back to you for any comments or anybody else. This is WS2M for the space portion of the TechNet.
And then I'm going to turn it over to the group to see if anyone else has any further questions for you on any of the above subjects or anything to do with space. Detecting gravity waves, boy, is that difficult. Wow. Understanding gravity, my goodness, is that difficult. I think lots of real smart minds, Einstein and others, have tried to figure out what is gravity. Yeah, you've detected the Higgs particle that gives things mass, and gravity is proportional to the amount of mass. That's how much we know. What is it? And you heard me say so often, I'm still puzzled by the fact that they believe gravity is spread by gravity waves. Let me drop. And they believe gravity waves move at the speed of light. That's as good a guess as any. Let me drop. And so, if it moves at the speed of light, just like light does, and light can't move, can't leave a black hole, because the escape velocity of a black hole is by definition greater than the speed of light, then can ask the question, how do gravity waves leave if they move at the speed of light? Apparently gravity waves are not slowed down by gravity, whereas light waves are. Whenever a source of light at a long distance away from a massive object, like a really far away galaxy, and you've got an intermediate, very heavy galaxy, the light wave is bent, gravity lensing effect. So if gravity will act as a lens to light, the propagation of a light wave, does it act as a lens to a gravity wave? Apparently not. I think gravity waves are immune to their own gravity. There's a pun there somewhere. There's a lot we don't know, Paul. And some of those answers out there in space. You said that we've got some errors or some things that are failing on the International Space Station. I seem to remember one of the last spacewalks tried to do a repair, and I believe that, I think it was the ammonia cooling system, I think is only partially working because of a failure. Isn't that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet?
Yeah, they got that working. That was successful. And originally, a couple of years ago, they had a problem, and they thought they had it nailed down, and they went through this whole bypass system for one of the radiators out on P6, the port side. They realized that, after doing this whole change, that they still had, they were losing ammonia. So after some time, leak actually got bigger, and they did a spacewalk. Sonny Williams was involved, another guy, and they did a spacewalk. did find out conclusively what the answer was, what they used to dig. They're called CMG. Let me drop it. The control moment gyroscopes. There's four of them on the space station. And these things are not what I was thinking originally. You know, they had, I'm thinking reaction wheels, you know, like some of these other spacecraft have. They differ from the reaction wheels system. And the amount of work that you could do and mass that you could do is, you know, give me an idea where you have a few hundred watts of, you know, and just a couple of hundred kilograms of mass using the control moment gyroscopes. You could produce thousands of newtons of meters of torque, you know, where if you use the reaction wheel system, which I was thinking about last week during the week, I think we got cut short on that one, that conversation. But just to finish up on that, the reaction wheels would require, they say, megawatts of power. So there's a big difference. And I found out the theory of how these things work and how it actually operates and how it turns to the space station. So if you ever want to listen to that, we can do that as well. Back to you, Dick.
So the CMGs, controlled moment gyroscope, if I've got a very large gyroscope spinning, let's assume that the axis is perpendicular to the Earth, and I take the top of that axle and start pushing it toward the north, the gyroscope always responds at right angles. It will create a force, east or west, so to speak, depending on whether I'm rotating clockwise or counterclockwise on the gyroscope. So whatever force you put on a gyroscope's axis to try to change the orientation of the axis, get a right angle force. So as long as you plan it correctly, as long as the force that you're applying to the axle is at right angles to the force you desire, the gyroscope will give that to you. Is that the method by which the CMGs do reorientation of the International Space Station? Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, this is one of the difficulties with ham radio. We're not seeing one another. If you told me that, what you just said, Dick, I wouldn't be able to understand that. And I'll try to explain to you what I found out from reading it, and my guess is hopefully you understand what I'm talking about. But first of all, you have four of these things, and each gyro found out weighs 600 pounds. I mean, this is like a freaking piano. That's the mass of the spinning gyro. And naturally, it's got a motor attached to it. And the RPMs are 6,600 RPMs. I mean, that's close to red line on my car. I mean, now, you have four of these lined up, you know, in different directions, you know, because it wants to, they utilize it for different movements of the space station. And the whole setup is mounted in what they call the Z1